Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Samson Knight. Now, Samson is a writer and graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop in Iowa City, where he was a Truman Capote Fellow. The book we're talking about today, Likeness, is his second novel. In his other life, he is an assistant professor at University of Toronto's Rotman School of Management and a faculty affiliate at the University of Toronto School of Cities, where he studies quantitative marketing, optimal targeting, and machine learning. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Samson.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So I have a question. Were you a writer first and then you got into all the quant stuff, or was it the other way around?
Yeah, I usually describe it to people as I feel like my dad raised me like, you know how like Russians decide who's going to go to the like Olympics and gymnastics when the kid is like four? My dad sort of like sat me down in front of a keyboard when I was like 4 or 5 years old, because he'd always wanted, he was sort of like a writer manque, where he had a memoir that he'd always wanted to publish. He's like a great guy, but he never managed to get it sold. But when I was very small, maybe like 4 or 5 years old, he started me writing my own short story. And then sort of like every year from there, got me enrolled in like theater classes, and just really sort of like nurtured the dream to an extent where like I really love it, but I've never really been able to tell. Like I think I was.
Is it you or is it what you were, was expected of you?
Yeah, and I've always been really grateful, because I think it's a great kind of spiritual place to exist in. Like trying to write is sort of like this this state of presence that I think is a really high form of existing. So I'm really grateful to him for setting me on this path. But it'd always been my default for most of my life, and then I got into college. I went to Oberlin. Largely, I got in because my sister went there and is much smarter than me. I applied to the creative writing program and I didn't get in. And I never accounted for the possibility that writing might not love me back. I felt so burned. As many 18-year-old boys do, I took an econ class. I enjoyed it. Since then, I've sort of, especially I think because of my dad's sort of like trials and tribulations trying to make a writing career work, I've never trusted it entirely as sort of the only vessel for my sort of like career path. So I've maintained a very healthy, a robust day job. I've always enjoyed econ and a lot of these other applications, but I would say that writing is usually where my identity resides, where sort of like my eye, I feel like, lives more in that world. I've cultivated over time, like I think a deep enjoyment of a lot of those other quantitative things, but nothing's as fun as writing.
Well, there's it's really interesting, because for a lot of writers, it's the parents saying, get a day job, get a day job. You can't count on this, know? And so you had the opposite. I am also in both worlds, because in my day job, I'm actually a CFO. So
lovely.
Of a company that I started that has hundreds of employees around the world. So it's
wow. Well, and I imagine, honestly, I think that in many ways they're actually easier compliments than folks who try to make it work with a creative day job and a creative, not to say that being an academic is definitely creative. I should all of my colleagues who may be listening. A creative writing day job, and then also a creative writing like weekend job, I suppose you might call it, or sort of like any minute that you have in the day, because they tend to draw from similar sort of wellsprings of energy. Whereas I felt like, especially in grad school, there would be sort of like parts of the day where I would have sort of like a lot of sort of like really bright energy, where I could just sit down and write. And then, you know, eventually you're ready to take a break, and I would have a completely different energy getting just very frustrated coding. I remember something my one of my professors told me in writing school, where she was like, you know, a lot of young writers, they like really believe that if they just write for like 10 to 12 hours a day, they'll get more done. And I can really tell a mature writer, because she says, like, I think like Tim O'Brien and Murakami, I think famously does this, Don DeLillo, they'll write for like 2-3 hours and then go running. And they're just like very regular. They have very sort of like a built out other energies that they kind of inhabit and switch to. And in some ways, I think having like a very different, I'm looking for the right word here, alternative career, parallel career. That's what I look for, parallel career. I think it takes a little bit less potentially than something that might be sort of like drawing from the same kind of like part of the chromatic scale of your sort of day.
And of course, a lot of writers, their day job is teaching writing, which, in fact, when I started reading your bio and it said you're at the University of Toronto's, and I thought, well, they must teach writing there too. And then I get to that.
They do. I've been in touch with a couple of the writing faculty here. They're super nice.
Yeah.
I do think that that definitely gives you a lot. But I, like my, I met my partner at while we were both doing our MFA. We were in workshop together, which was a grueling first dating experience. She teaches creative writing, and she's a phenomenal teacher. But I think sometimes she does talk about how on a day that she's teaching, she has trouble writing that day. And it's like a little bit more sort of like an energy exchange. But at the same time, she loves teaching and does get a lot of sort of like ideas, and it can be very fruitful in other ways.
So she's giving the creative energy to her students on those days.
Yeah. It's a lot of like, and I mean, to be fair, I do sometimes feel that way when I'm like teaching business classes. It's a lot of performance. I think it's, but it can be fertile, you know, like you can have that, those discussions, and then you write the next day.
So your MFA was at the University of Iowa Writers Workshop, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And which is known to be very, internally competitive.
Yeah.
So how did that play out in meeting your partner there, and you're both writers? And
yeah, I think I had this sort of fortuitous experience. You could call it fortuitous. Where so I went to econ grad school before I went to Iowa. So I went to econ to Iowa actually while I was on a 2-year leave for my PhD. So I started at Brown. I did my quals, and then I went to writing school. And I thought that writing school would be a lot like econ school, which is to say that it's grad school. Everyone's just head down in their own work, and nobody really thinks that much about each other because they're all like too busy. We're all sort of just like drowning in it. And Iowa had a lot of sort of like unstructured time, so you had to kind of, you know, build your own ocean to drown in. But I figured that everyone else was kind of on this track. But what ended up happening was I purely by coincidence, I have a very large family, and I went to 5 weddings in the first month I was at Iowa, and that turned out to be like a really key social formation month. So there was all of these social groups that were forming that I was just totally blissfully unaware of. And for my first semester, I remember I had like one friend at Iowa, which I thought in grad school is like pretty good. I think you get one friend, it's great. Shout out to my one friend if you're listening, you're a great guy. Also my other friends. He was always mentioning, he was like, gosh, there's all these things happening and no one's inviting us to all this stuff and everyone's saying this, that, and the other about us. And I was like, man, you got to get out of your head. Nobody's having events. Nobody's doing like having parties. Like nobody's talking about us. No one has time. And then I met my partner who was she was actually had friends. And I realized, oh no, we weren't being invited to anything. Everyone was talking bad about us the whole time. And I still remember that first semester as this glorious sort of like I was released from all FOMO. There was no sense that anyone felt anything about the competitive environment just hadn't touched me because I had sort of accidentally just been kind of floating in my own sphere. But then once I arrived, it became I realized that, oh, there are a lot of people are getting together and we're all talking about each other. And like, oh, gosh, this is exhausting. And they're all everyone's all great people, but it was a very intense environment. Yeah, like I said, I think it's part of the workshop. Like it feels structural to workshops that you're just like you're so vulnerable to each other. You often feel ganged up on. Mm. You vent to other people, and you sort of form social groups that feel like you can protect yourself by being like, well, this person who criticized me, they suck anyway. and especially in a program the size of Iowa, I feel like with smaller programs, you tend to have like one of two very extreme equilibriums where either you have everyone is like getting along great. They're all one big social group and they're like the best of friends for their entire lives. Or it's kind of like,
at nobody's each other's throats.
Yeah, and Iowa is large enough to sustain some sort of like overlapping circles. Mm. And so I think that's what creates the kind of constant competitive environment. It was still like an amazing experience. And I honestly do think that anyone who feels stressed out at Iowa just needs to do a different grad school right before because that place was a dream. It was so much fun. After sort of like having just gone through qualifying exams, I was like, this is incredible.
And probably the weather didn't bother you. Are you Canadian?
Well, I'm from Boston.
Oh, you're from Boston. Originally. Okay. Okay.
My family's Canadian. Yeah.
So the winters were okay.
Yes. No, honestly, it was like the wind was surprising. I was a big biker. I biked everywhere and it cut through. Yeah. It was fierce. But no, it was within the range of what I'd known before.
So, Samson, did you write your first novel while you were in that program, The Diver?
I actually wrote The Diver. I guess I wrote this novel actually while I was at Iowa. This has been like my baby, and this has been the novel that it's for the longest time been kind of nearest and dearest to my heart. The Diver, I actually wrote in a kind of a headlong rush right before I finished my PhD program, where I had this like 3-month period where I finished my dissertation and I wasn't interviewing for jobs yet. And I had just failed to get an agent for this book.
Okay.
an earlier version of this book. Okay. And I've been working on it for years and years. And it was like, I knew that so much of my best writing was in these pages, but they just weren't quite fitting. This was sort of like a, I guess sort of like a 400, 450 page version of what is now a novella.
Yeah. wow. Okay.
If you want to know about the journey towards this novella, I'm sure that's a question we'll get to later on today. But I come close, but I hadn't quite found the home for it. And then was basically, I'd given myself this feeling that like, I knew that becoming that whatever happened next, I wouldn't have nearly as much flexibility as I did in grad school. And so I kind of in this last desperation heave, I took this short story that had been the most successful piece of my writing to date, which was this short story that won a prize that I wrote at Iowa about a woman who I guess accidentally drowns her husband. The idea is that she has a panic attack while they're scuba diving because they both run out of oxygen way, way down below. There's like a malfunction with her equipment. She kind of misapprehends potential. It's not clear if she misunderstands or if she's just like what the reality is, but she gets the sense that he's leaving her behind. And she elbows him in the throat, takes the last of the oxygen and leaves him behind. And then goes back to the surface. I'd always thought it was one of my stronger pieces of writing. It had always it had been the most successful sort of like one of the most successful stories I'd placed at that point. And But I'd always felt stuck because I was like, well, where do I go from here? At that point, after I'd finally, I had this sort of like, I petered out, it felt like, with this kind of book about my kind of family background and my parents' open marriage. I was like, I finally got this idea that, well, I guess for the story to move forward, she has to try to bring him back. And so then the diver becomes about her journey to try and resurrect her husband after murdering him on the ocean floor.
Wow. Now, are you a scuba diver?
No, this was actually, I was almost a scuba diver. This story came out of a abortive attempt to learn how to scuba dive, where I, a friend and I were traveling together. We were going to take scuba lessons together. I started doing like the stage one of scuba lessons. Just by coincidence, I watched all 20 hours of videos. You know, they make you do all of the like, all of the prep. It took a very long time. But then on the actual day when I was doing my pool lessons, I just happened to be very hungover. I just happened to be, I'm at the Iowa Writers Workshop and I'm very hungover. I don't know how it happened. this was after I,
Okay.
I got underwater and I just started to feel this like profound dread. And, you know, I just had this thought, I still remember, that was just like, you know, I'm a grown up. I don't have to do things I don't want to. And then I got out of the pool. And then I decided that in order to make all those 20 hours of videos worth it, I had to write exactly why I didn't want to go scuba diving. and so I wrote this story about someone who's having a panic attack underwater and does something absolutely devastating. And so sort of this accidental research project process that I had to kind of rationalize ex post. I am now actually, a lot of my friends tell me I should go scuba diving. I feel like I'm like professionally, I feel like now I'm in kind of like an anti scuba diver. I have an anti scuba diver reputation. but I should probably give it another chance. I hear it's amazing, and I
don't know. Once I've read your story, I probably would never try it.
Yeah, you know, it's freaky.
Yeah. I don't think it's for me. Yeah. So Samson, let's talk about likeness. You said this is sort of inspired by your parents' open marriage, which obviously they're very open. They must be very open about the fact that they have an open marriage. Are they comfortable with you talking about it publicly this?
Well, I think, you know, it's like I said, my dad wrote a lot about his own life. And so I think he kind of broke the seal on writing about a lot of aspects of his life and sort of our lives together. He especially really loved doing like performance pieces around. I think I would broadly say that like the book really isn't. It's not like a version of my family exactly. It's sort of like a it's like inspired by the situation. How could I have made sense of this if I was in their positions? But none of the characters are really based on them. It was interesting when I showed it to some of like members of my family. They were like, very supportive, but they're also just sort of like, this is not us. This is not him. This is not me. This is like, it's not really, and it's not at all. It's not actually. Them in their situation going through what they did, but it's sort of like me trying to imagine this sort of like this period where everyone has like different versions, but a kind of collective set of like particular facts around one very dramatic point, and try and understand like if I was in everyone's position, like how does this make sense? How do people, and in some ways it was almost I feel like everyone should write a novella from the perspective of people in their parents' positions. Because it's very reconciling of sort of like really seeing like sympathizing, I think, with like a lot of very complicated aspects of what I imagine the pressures that they faced, and kind of like the details of kind of how they made sense of themselves in those decisions. But yeah, I think that it's like, it's, I would say loosely based is probably the best descriptor there.
Okay. Okay. And the, you don't really, in the book, you're not, you're showing the complexities of an open marriage, but you're not really judging whether it's right or wrong or works or doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, it's really more like a specific relationship, you know, and it just has its own dynamics and its own kind of like loves and stresses. And it's in some ways, I think actually the I try to they're making it work. They're trying to figure out how to make it work.
Right, right.
And I think that it's also it's more about this specific arrangement than any sort of like any feeling about open marriage kind of writ large, because it's sort of like everyone has a different definition of that term in this context, and so yeah.
Now you leave the ending pretty open, and I actually thought you could have gone further. And probably you did if you had 400 words to begin with.
I was gonna say, it's funny that you mentioned. Yeah.
So yeah. What made you decide to end it here at this point?
Yes, yeah, so I think in some ways it was like a kind of mercenary decision. There's a great quote by Ethan Kanan where it's sort of like, no novel is ever finished, they're only abandoned. And I felt like when I was like working with this one, I felt like I like figured out, I think, how to have this kind of unit of sort of like this kind of like parent generation trying to make sense of their situation, and then beyond that I tried to write towards like actually my what would be based on sort of like myself and my half siblings growing up, and I came to believe that it was just sort of like more of a second book than an actual second half of a book. Because I think the struggle that I kept encountering was that the kind of threads of tension that I was building in these first sections were very hard to sort of progress in the right way when I was also then suddenly moving towards you know, like half siblings meeting each other at various points in their lives. And a lot of what I struggled with the main draft was this feeling of like that the book just had these sort of these reset points where it sort of like then started a completely different book. And so I decided to actually let it be a different book.
Okay. Okay. Are you Bobby?
I am actually I'm the other.
You're the other side. Okay, you're the other kid. Yeah. The unnamed one.
Bobby positionally would be my my half brother.
Okay.
Who also when I was writing the book, he was most excited. He was like, you can cut everyone else. You can't cut me. he really wanted to be in the book. He was like, no. he's very excited.
Okay. So why don't you kind of describe how this book is structured, what it's kind of, you know, what you're willing to say about the plot without any spoilers.
Absolutely. Yeah. Spoiler alert. I would say that this is sort of about a complicated polyamorous relationship where these people fall in love, and one of the partners really doesn't want to have a sort of exclusive relationship. And at the beginning of the relationship, this feels like kind of a small ask, but as they get more and more involved, they come to sort of a compromise where one of the partners is less enthusiastic than the other about sort of like the structure, but they're okay. They have sort of, they make it work. They're in love with each other, and things feel like they have a mutual understanding. And then this mutual understanding is sort of monumentally challenged when kids get involved, and the sort of the marital partner in this polyamorous relationship is 2 months pregnant, and then learns that her husband's partner, one of her husband's partners, is also pregnant. And for her, this is a massive violation of what she felt was their sort of like hard won mutual understanding and kind of compromise around openness, and to him is just sort of something that they need to figure out. And the book is sort of the process starting from like their relationship and the wife's perspective of kind of figuring out how to go forward from this and how to make sense of sort of like her whole relationship in this context, kind of like reinterpreting how she got here. And then the second part of the book, we also visit sort of the external partner to this open marriage and what it's like for her trying to make her life work kind of on other people's terms often. And as we've sort of touched on, this was an event that largely tracked to like my own birth, that like my parents had an open relationship with a similar type of sort of event where my brother, my half brother and I are a month apart in age. So he was born in April. I was born in May. We're now extremely close. He was the best man at my wedding. I was the best man at his wedding. He's like, but we didn't actually meet until we were seven, because our mothers lived in sort of like different areas, and you know, there was a lot to like, and like now I understand there was a lot going on in the background that of people getting comfortable with various aspects.
Did you know about each other before then?
We did. I, cause my dad would go visit. And so, like every once in a while, he lived with us primarily. But he would, I guess it's sort of like, from my half brother's perspective, probably analogous to certain people's arrangements with like sort of like divorced parents, where like every like other weekend, or probably more like every month or two, my dad would go out and visit my half brother. And then around when Victor was seven, they started visiting. He started visiting over the summer. So first, just for like a weekend, we did not get along. We were supposed to share a bedroom, and like it was very intense for reasons that I like really didn't understand. Like my mom had set up a mattress on the floor, and Victor was like, "I'm not sleeping on the floor," and I was like, "Well, but okay." and then eventually we I would say we kind of came around when we started we were like 11 or 12, we started going through puberty together, and actually it was great to have just sort of like a summer friend who would just like he would come out and stay with us for, at that point, sort of like a month, 2 months. And we would share a room and sort of became like part-time twins. So he would, and it was, again, sort of things that like, I was raised in this, I think a very intentional way where my dad in particular was like, this is actually totally normal. you know, when you're until you're 12, you're sort of like, all right.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And like this is, and he was like, some people are just like very far right Christians and will disapprove of this. But those people are incredibly conservative, or feminists. is how he would and you know, I'm like nine, and I'm like, okay, yeah, those people are crazy. It was explained to me in a certain way where it was like you know, fish and water, or all of those analogies. I started to appreciate, I think, later on how my half brother was always really grateful to my mom for being really open to like him coming every summer and sort of like really integrating our lives together, and everyone actually becoming getting to know each other. And so that I think was sort of in the background. Something that people got comfortable with over like a long period of time. But for me, it was just kind of the normal course of getting to know probably would be analogous to like maybe like people who are close to extended family and sort of like, yeah, like at a certain point you become close in this particular way. Yeah. And then, you know, I became a teenager and I was like, wait a minute.
it occurred.
I've been having this wait a minute experience for a long time.
But like that maybe this isn't the way most of the world operates and be a little unusual. And but you're right, you know, there with so much divorce and remarriage and blended families, and it's not that unusual. Yeah. And we have a tendency to think that all of this just is happening now and that, you know, 50, 100 years ago, it wasn't, but that is not true. There was a lot of unusual family structures, always, probably since time began. Yeah. And, and you know, sometimes you find out, you have a belief that everybody's living by these set of rules, and then you realize, no, they're not. Whereas you had the opposite, you didn't think there was a set of rules, and then you found out there was.
Well, and I still I want to be like cautious in how I'm describing this and the book too, because I think there's a lot of sensitivity too about like because I have a lot of friends who like, you know, when I went to Oberlin, right? So I met lots of poly people as one does at Oberlin, and a lot of those were my close friends who experimented and continue actually to have like poly relationships. And I think that when I was first submitting this story, the like first chapter of this to workshops, sometimes it would set people off because it could be it's a sensitive stereotype that there's one partner who is uncomfortable with or less comfortable with the arrangement, but kind of doing it as a compromise to the other person. And it's a stereotype that I think a lot of people in poly relationships really chafe against, because they're like, actually, no, I am empowered here, and don't assume that I'm not on board with this. And it's sort of been like it's a delicate type of book to write, sort of like engaging with that stereotype, which I always want to foreground. I'm sort of like, this is based on my actual experience, and so I feel I hope that I'm not pushing this as some sort of like stereotype of these sort of, as you say, sort of like these alternative family structures that often end up being actually just like more people that love each other in the long run a lot of different types of situations. But it was also the case that like there was like a power dynamic that was sort of unequal at points, and just the particular shape that it took in the context of my background was around this type of sort of relationship structure. And but it's more just like how any book about a troubled marriage is not a condemnation of marriage.
right. And I would say, you know, I've had friends who've experimented with polyamory, and I think it's usually true that one partner is way more into it than the other.
Just from my personal experience. I often approach it as I have this weird analogy, and this is I guess one of the rare moments where I let myself talk as an economist. But I feel like it's a little bit like it's like deregulation. You know, it's sort of when you deregulate, like there can be moments when there's actually like you find these things that are work way better for everyone. But also in a lot of cases, the rules are in place because the people who might have less power can't sort of like keep the people of more power, like can't set the rules for people of more power.
Right.
And so there tends to be I think there can be a tendency that when you take away a lot of rules, the person who has more power in the relationship sets the terms. And that can be unfair, or something that sort of like, it can get very complicated very fast, I guess. And it did in the context of my family background. And it's not to say that it's always happening when there are sort of like relationships with less rules.
And it's not always the man who's got the power in that relationship either.
Absolutely. Definitely.
But that's interesting what you're talking about, deregulation, because there seems to be this group of people who, like, all regulations are bad. No. And as soon as we deregulate, something bad usually happens. and then there's this push for more regulation, and then but every regulation, government regulation, needs to be kind of reviewed periodically. Does this still make sense? Does it work?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's not regulation bad, deregulation good, or vice versa. It's
So I
think that's true with relationships too.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a model that I don't know. I hope I don't get my friends who are in that I'm in poly relationships. I hope I'm not misrepresenting them, but I think they would often kind of describe kind of healthy a healthy arrangement in that way, where it's not necessarily like there's no rules. It's just that we've agreed on different set, and sort of like we're revisiting them, as you say, and it's actually. And that's often part of a healthy balance of having like a really clear mutual understanding. And that's basically what's not going on in this book.
Yes. So, Samson, would you like to read a little bit from Likeness for us?
Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
So I'm going to read a excerpt that's from the second part, actually. So I think... this minor potential spoilers. Is that all right?
Sure. That's totally up to you.
All right, great. So I think all you really need to know from this is that Sandy is the kind of outside partner of this open marriage. She has a newborn that she's been really struggling with, and she's also been having these wild lucid dreams that have been kind of really arresting, and she's been trying to make sense of. So this is from her diary, and this is entitled April 11th. Trying to figure out on the day after whether you did something accidentally humiliating the night before has to be the worst feeling in the history of human emotion. Possibly it's wrong to call it a feeling, the worst constellation of feelings, the worst spiritual condition, the worst kind of thought you hear echoing over and over and over inside your head. Of course, it's not truly the worst, but part of the feeling, the constellation, the condition is the sense that it is. The dinner was really nice to start with. Sebastian showed up only a few minutes after I got in from work, and I was still nursing Bobby when I opened the door for him, so he took it upon himself to do pretty much everything. He unpacked the groceries he'd brought, cleared off and wiped down the kitchen counters, chopped up a tomato and a red onion and a head of broccoli and a ball of mozzarella, and arranged it all on the pizza crust he'd picked up from the store, and then he did the dishes, and he asked interesting questions while the pizza cooked. It took real effort not to be charmed. I put Bobby down to roll around on his favorite blanket and told Sebastian all about the latest awkwardnesses at the diner, about Mr. Walker's worsening attempts to flirt with Alice, and my suspicion that Esther wasn't pooling all of her tips. And he told me about the new shopping center that he and his team were laying the foundations for, about all the corruption that had gone into the project so far and all the corruption that was still planned for later, and also how odd it was to be the foreman now of all his former coworkers, to be the man in charge over his old friends. Apparently it wasn't so awkward, except when they had to make eye contact and they had to figure out how long to look at one another. And then it was just excruciatingly weird. I laughed. He tried to demonstrate his point by looking me in the eye in the weirdest possible way, squinting with one eye and staring wide with the other. And I smiled and squinted and stared back at him. And then I stood from my chair and hunched over like a monkey. And he mirrored me and we started circling each other around the kitchen, leering and hooting and pointing and scratching at our armpits and jumping around from foot to foot, two chimps facing off over territory. He laughed and I giggled, and Bobby got so overwhelmed by all the energy and physicality that he started to cry. I picked him up and rocked him on my hip, still giggling a little bit. Sebastian went and grabbed some grapes from the fridge and sang to us while I swayed with Bobby, and he ate the grapes at the table. Some Cat Stevens song, Trouble, I think it was. And for a moment, it was like we were a normal family. For a little flash of a moment, it was like I could see the whole scene from a stranger's perspective. Like I was looking down from above, and Sebastian was the generic, well-meaning dad, and Bobby was the generic, cranky newborn, and I was the generic, happy mother, the exhausted but happy mother. All of us arranged around the table like a sample Christmas card in a shop window, as three. And then the sensation passed, and we were only ourselves again. Sebastian popped a grape into his mouth and popped it out directly above him like a cannonball. And or rather like a seal bouncing a ball above its nose. And then he caught the grape with his tongue and gulped it down. The tiredness thickened above my eyelids as though hours had gone by.
Bobby pushed his chest into my, pushed his head into my chest and whimpered. It was less of an argument than I would have thought. It sounded less like an argument than I'd expected in any case. No voices were raised and there was barely any eye contact. Not when we put Bobby down in his room together and not when we took the pizza out of the oven and not when we sat down to eat while we were sitting there eating our falling apart slices, catching the sizzling hot tomato sauce on our fingertips. I started telling him that I needed more help from him with Bobby at the same time that he started telling me how he'd recently begun a new spiritual awakening. And then those two conversations somehow both continued, but in parallel, almost without touching at all. He said, oh, sure, before I'd quite finished asking, and then continued, but it's the strangest thing, and went on to say that he'd become increasingly preoccupied with the idea of births in particular and the continuity of consciousness beforehand and afterward. And I interrupted him to say that I wanted him to be around every weekend at least, especially when I was working and just needed help with cooking and cleaning. And he nodded and said he'd talk to Anne and then asked me about my dreams, which I hadn't actually mentioned to him yet. And I was so surprised by the question that I forgot what I was about to say and instead stuttered something about my purposeful hallucinations, and his eyes practically popped out of his head, and I smiled and said, but I really mean it, Sebastian, about the weekends. And he nodded without hearing a single word and moved his chair closer to me and asked me to tell him everything. And I grinned despite my misgivings and told him everything, the falling and the tickling and the spiraling down, the soaring out, the exhaustion when I woke and the feeling of closeness to myself. And he was so struck that he stood and sat down and then stood again and started pacing, shaking his head as he listened, smiling and smiling, his mouth open as he breathed. Incredible, he said. A silence opened up between us that wasn't a silence at all. And then he remembered that he bought hot chocolate on his grocery shop, and I put some hot water on to make mugs. And he mentioned that he'd have to go soon, and also that he'd begun speaking to God recently, confiding this to me in a voice like a confession, like he didn't want anyone else in the kitchen to overhear. And I creased my brow and blinked at him as he detailed his encounter with the Archangel Michael at the construction site after dark, and the names the angel had taught him, the modes of address he'd given to him to communicate with the Creator on his own. I thought that Sebastian was staying the night. We drank the hot chocolate faster than I expected, and then he stood and moved to the door, and I told him again that I needed him to help more with Bobby, as in today or tomorrow or at least this coming weekend, and he said again that he'd talk to Anne about it, and I was too bewildered to realize how angry I was at this response until he'd already shut the door, his footsteps on the stairs, and then gone. It was a feeling not so much of smallness as of great distance, a feeling of looking down from miles and miles above on a body that's furious for not being seen up close. I walked around the kitchen for about 5 minutes, just walking back and forth and pretending that I couldn't hear Bobby squawking again, a different squawk, higher pitched, his mommy, I feel gassy sound. And then I went into his room and burped him and then packed up all his baby essentials and followed after Sebastian with Bobby in a carrier in the back seat of the car, his stroller folded up and jammed next to me in shotgun, and then a bag packed with diapers and formula wedged in the leg space underneath. Feeling somewhat mentally uncertain, but also physically entirely sure, a certain firmness in my shoulders, a straightness in my neck. Things were moving quickly, but I was moving quicker, it felt like, turning through yellow lights in the exact half second before they turned red, or maybe the exact half second after. I pulled up across the street from what I thought was Sebastian's house and climbed out to double check the address. I'd only been to the place once before, 1 week when Sebastian's wife hadn't been there, and it was hard to tell at night if it was the right building. Bobby had been making his lower-pitched, throaty noises all the drive over, but it was only when I was outside the car that I finally heard him, his sounds coming muffled through the chassis, and I started to feel guilty for ignoring him. The houses on the road all looked too similar to tell apart. The car shushed past on the pavement, and I backed up against the driver's side door to let it pass. I was going to carry Bobby up to the front porch of Sebastian's house, and I was going to make him take him. I was going to scream at his front walls until he was forced to come to the door. I was going to burn his house down to ashes. I got back into the car and drove home.
Thank you. That was Samson Knight reading from Likeness. I think you're the best reader I've ever had on this show in almost 20 years. That was incredible. You talked about teaching being a performance, and I can see you. I bet you do this with every lecture, don't you?
I was raised as a theater kid. I was okay. From youth.
That's fantastic. Fantastic. lucid dreaming. For anyone who's not familiar with that, can you explain what that is?
Absolutely. Yeah, I had some like, I briefly became obsessed with sort of like sleep journeys, I guess sort of psychonautical adventures, where I when I was like 22 or 23, I would do these experiments on myself. Sorry, I should explain this actually in order. Lucid dreaming is when you are able to, you're conscious that you're in a dream and you're able to mold your dream around you. So you know that you're dreaming, but you don't wake up. And my experience of lucid dreaming, which is something that I was kind of wrapping around to the long way, was there's a period of my life when I basically figured out how to induce lucid dreaming, where if you go to sleep in a particular way, with and it's a very difficult way, you can kind of half fall asleep without entirely losing the thread of, I guess, what would the Freudians call it, like ego, like the I, the sort of stream of consciousness, you can kind of maintain a certain sense of sort of awareness in the dream, and then you just get the dream. The dream can just sort of unfold a little bit at your will. It gets a little bit out of control very quickly because your idle thoughts also affect your dream, in my experience. So I would often start lucid dreaming and I would wonder what it felt like to die. And then I would fall and die in the dream. But because and then I'd wake up. So I kept lucid dreaming and then falling from great heights, because I couldn't help not thinking that, you know, because what happens in the dream is what you think. And so I would sort of like, I had enough control to start off the lucid dreaming, but not enough control not to kill myself right away. I think a lot of other people have much more pleasant experiences of lucid dreaming, and I did it a couple times, but yeah, it's largely when you're aware that you're dreaming in the dream and can change the dream as you go.
And do you still do this, like occasionally you thought, oh, tonight I'm gonna go to sleep this way and have this lucid dream?
No, I don't actually know if it would work anymore. There was a period, because you have to be pretty exhausted, and the way that I would do it basically is you just, there's not that much trick to it. You just lie totally motionless and just try to keep your head awake, but sort of like you fall asleep in like the most uncomfortable way possible, basically, by you have to let your body fall asleep without your mind. So you have to do all of the things where like you just leave your body just kind of itches for a while, you feel these tickles, because your body essentially tests whether you're awake by giving you a bunch of like itch sensations, and you have to ignore them for like going on an hour, and then eventually your body actually just subsides without your brain, and so your body totally falls asleep. And then my experience of it is then you enter the sort of like, you know, the tornado dream state, where like you have these kind of like, I guess, synaptic jerks. You start to sort of like spiral into a dream. So it's kind of unpleasant. I don't do this anymore. But for a period, I was like, I would very purposefully, this is, you could tell why I showed up to Iowa and made no friends. I was a very strange, individual for much of my life. My wife has made me a much better version of myself.
I was going to say, you seem pretty normal to me, but now, do you remember lucid dreams better than other dreams? Or are they still, like, my experience is I can remember a dream so vividly when I first wake up, and then half an hour later, it is gone.
I think it's hard to say, because I think probably, but but partly it's because I then tell them to other people.
Right.
You know,
right.
I'm like, look, I lucid dreamed, I did it.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I'm like telling it to myself, you know. Yeah. So I feel like they would probably evaporate just as fast if I treated them as everyday occurrences, in the way that I do with my normal dreams.
So Samson, earlier you mentioned with likeness that you were having trouble getting an agent, and then so you went and wrote this other book, and you were able to sell that, and then you came back to likeness and cut it by a third, basically. And
two-thirds.
Two-thirds, okay. And two-thirds, yeah. And So how did that, then how were you able to find your publisher? And it's published by the University of Iowa Press, so which is a great university press. And how'd that process work for you?
So a lot of it, honestly, was actually out of the relationships that I, because University of Iowa published my first book as well. And a lot of it actually was very, followed directly from that, where I basically came to Jim McCoy, who's the phenomenal editor in charge of University of Iowa Press. And I kind of told him the story of this draft that I felt had a lot, still felt had a lot of my best writing, but I had had never quite managed to find the right form for and to get these pieces kind of like fitting together. And so he actually really generously just worked with me on it. So we actually, because I was, I felt so burned from how many times I'd tried to get it over the finish line and wasn't able to, that I really wanted, I needed like someone to work with me. I needed someone to really help me believe that it was still going to have a future in the world. And, you know, Jim really helpfully and patiently sort of like helped me bring it to this final form. And we found sort of like, we're like, okay, like, you know, like like these other parts, like the parts basically about myself and my half siblings, like meeting each other and growing up, I'm really excited to write as a next book. And in the immediate term, sort of like we figured out how to make these this kind of opening novella be its own thing on its own terms, and kind of allowed them to reach their own logic separately. And yeah, full credit to Jim there for really believing in this as a project. And it's and yeah, I will always be just incredibly grateful to him for helping kind of bring this into existence, because it has always been what I feel is sort of like a this is really devastating Marilyn Robinson quote about how your writing is a reflection of your soul. That always feels like so anxious as a writer. And I'm always sort of like I've always felt like this book is closer to myself than I think a lot of other pieces that I've ever done, where I felt like this was the I really want this to be in the world.
And it comes out July 29th, 2025. Yeah, we're recording this a little bit in advance of that, and you may hear this a little bit in advance of that. But you must have reader, you know, the advanced reader copies, so you're holding, you're able to hold the physical book in your hand, right? How does that feel?
Really, really phenomenal. Yeah, no, I'm so happy this book is in the world, and just so happy to everybody who helped make that happen. And yeah.
So, likeness as the title. What's the meaning of that?
Yeah, so I think it's sort of about like the it kind of nests this feeling of who we're related to, you know, like who we have sort of like this like large sense of kind of like who do we actually have the likeness of, as well as the sense of sort of what I think trouble the in particular the first narrator is really dealing with is this feeling that they're sort of like doubled in their relationship, that they have this sort of like other partner who's doing these other who's like also with their husband, and sort of feeling like like there's this like unknown person who's sort of like also their husband's type, in this sort of like like this strange feeling of there's this person who I don't know, who I keep finding these weird similarities with, and it's like and then I think further down it's about like the kind of family likenesses that emerge. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And Anne, the wife in this book, is also a writer, like you.
Yes.
And at one point, she destroys all of her past writing. Have you ever done that?
not quite so dramatically. I didn't need like but I think emotionally the feeling it was a very cathartic section to write, because I think that was, especially as I talk about like you know, the many ups and downs of working on this project particularly, but I felt like a lot of what I was moving through there was and I guess actually I did almost do that, because this has gone through even that version that was sort of like 400 pages, there was a 300 page different version from there that I'd actually like totally scrapped and moved on from. And so I think in some ways it's sort of nested that happened to this book a few times, where there were pieces that remained, but I basically started from scratch at least two times over. Over I think the like 10 years of working on it.
Well, this was set in the 80s, so that would have been before a lot of people were writing digitally. But nowadays, if you happen to tear up or burn everything you ever wrote, you probably could recover it.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like I've, that's why I say I've sort of like, I have made that sort of like effective move, but also it's on my Dropbox backup.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, Samson, yeah. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. This was, a fun conversation.
And, thank you for having me.
And, you know, we always end with a quote. And so I looked for a quote about polyamory. And this comes from the novel Another Roadside Attraction by Tom Robbins, who, of course, is an amazing writer. And he says, a character in this book is saying, marriage is not a synonym for monogamy any more than monogamy is a synonym for ideal love. To live lightly on the earth, lovers and families must be more flexible and relaxed.
I love that.
So, thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.